The boilerplate issues were and still are abortion and same-sex marriage. Those are the issues that drive people to the polls. Those are the issues that James Dobson gets people all, gets them out to the polls for. It's not that evangelicals don't care about those issues anymore. What a great number of them are saying is, we care about abortion, we care about same-sex marriage, we're going to be conservative on those things, but we also care about poverty, we also care about AIDS in Africa, we also care about the economy, we also care about health insurance, we also care about education. And these broader issues are sort of mobilizing them as well.
All right, Lisa Miller, talking with us before the break. She was author of that Newsweek cover story, The Politics of Jesus. I'd like your reaction to what we had to say during that conversation. And then I've also got some questions to lay out before you. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Welcome back for the second hour of Issues, Etc. It's open lines for the next 25 minutes. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Open lines for your questions, your thoughts on the election as well. If you didn't get a chance to chime in yesterday, now is your opportunity. issuesetc@kfuo.org. And our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I should always know better. The guest who's coming up next walked into the studio just a few minutes ago. She had, what are these things called? Hey, the two of you. What did she bring in? What's it called, Sally, that you gave me to eat there?
It's toffee bark.
Toffee bark? Uh-huh. Oh, man, it was good. But there's a rule in radio, and it's don't eat right before they turn on the microphone, especially something like toffee bark, which was chocolate, and I don't know, it was very good.
Like a Heath bar.
Yeah, kind of like a Heath bar, and I did. So if I'm clearing my throat, please bear with me. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. So, in the course of that interview, one of the people who was held up among several, one of the people who was held up as perhaps the new exemplar of what the new religious voter, perhaps even the new evangelical voter, looks like is Bono, the lead singer of U2. You've seen him everywhere, running around with Oprah Winfrey, going on their shopping spree. A lot of the money that they spend, a lot of money that they give goes to very good things. Bono has championed the cause of AIDS and AIDS research, especially in Africa. So does Bono represent your political, your social concerns? Do you feel that you've shifted? They say there's been a shift in the religious voter, not away from things like gay marriage and abortion, but maybe a broadening of their concerns, a broadening of their issues. So do you think you've shifted? Are these your issues, AIDS and global warming and poverty? Would you call yourself Bono's called in the article in Newsweek, pro-life and pro-poor. And do you think that this much talked about shift in evangelical voters is real or merely manufactured by wishful thinking? Or are we reading all those numbers and those exit polls correctly? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Is the era of the religious right, as we have come to know it, coming to an end? And what about 65 to 70 million Roman Catholic voters? Very often, I think they are either ignored by the media or they are lumped together with evangelicals in a way that tends to confuse the issue. Faith-based initiatives, a good example. Faith-based initiatives was one of President George W. Bush's big plans when he was elected the first time. He brought it into the White House with him. He started an Office of Faith-Based Initiatives. He promised $8 billion a year. And many evangelicals were leery of that idea. They were leery of the money. Who wasn't? Roman Catholics and their charities. Nothing wrong with that. But by and large, the people who bought into the faith-based initiatives of the White House, insofar as they could be bought into because the money was so sparse, were Roman Catholics. They didn't feel as leery about the money. So one might argue, yesterday the president was asked about evangelical support and whether he had split it in the election. He said, I don't really know what you're talking about, and answered the question. And he went on to discuss faith-based initiatives, which hasn't turned out to be an evangelical issue as much as a Roman Catholic issue. And there are 65 to 70 million Roman Catholics in the United States. So do you think the media are overestimating, overstating the power and the influence of American evangelicals, or are they overplaying the so-called shift in the evangelical voters? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issue ZTC at KFUO.org. I do not consider myself an evangelical in a theological sense, not in the popular theological sense. In the old sense, yes, because that's what Lutherans were originally calling themselves, people of the gospel, evangelicals. With that said, politically, I don't consider myself necessarily an evangelical. However, if you lined up my issues, the things that get me to the polls, the things that get me punching the right ballot and or flipping the right lever, I'm going to be classified with the religious right, even though I don't consider myself philosophically or theologically a part of it. I'm going to be classified as one of the mainstream evangelical voters, even though I don't theologically or philosophically buy into a lot of that either. On the issues, I'm probably counted in that camp. And I don't feel like I've shifted. I don't feel like I didn't used to care about the environment, and now I do. I don't feel like I didn't used to care about the poor, and now I do. What about you? Let's talk with Steve, who calls from his car. Steve, welcome to Issues, Etc.
How are you doing?
Doing well.
You laid a couple of things on the table, so let me kind of go through them. First off, on the evangelicals, I think what it is they've gone from a myopic view of the world, which is very narrow, and they're kind of realizing, oh, there's more going on in this world. And I think they're kind of coming around to a little bit more of the way that, you know, traditional, like Lutherans see the world. There's a lot more to the world than one or two issues. So I don't think you moved. I don't think that you moved. I think they moved closer to you in that regard.
Okay, without making me a part of it, I'm glad that you said that. It's very insightful, Steve. Let me ask you this. Do you think that the era of the religious right, as we've come to know it, I don't think anybody needs to explain that, but do you think the era of the religious right politically is coming to an end?
I don't know if it's coming to an end, but I can see a significant weighing in their power in that, because I think what's happening is the almost religious support they gave the Bush administration, I think it's coming back to bite them big time. But one of my concerns about the evangelicals is understanding the difference between the right-hand and the left-hand kingdoms and what you do. And I think that a lot of evangelicals could confuse the works that we do for our fellow man in the left-hand kingdom as what Christ commands us to do as part of what the church is. And I can see them saying, well, you know, being a Christian isn't about what I believe. It's not about creeds. It's about deeds. And this is where Rick Warren, Saddleback, National Association of Evangelicals, theological minimalism becomes really dangerous, because people focus not on what I believe and how does what I do come out of what I believe, but what I do drives what I believe. So they put the cart before the horse.
All right. Thank you, Steve. Good thoughts. I could not be more concerned about the effects of the Rick Warren deeds, not creeds, reformation in the church. Now, in society, it probably will go along swimmingly and do all sorts of marvelous things for many people, which is to be applauded in society. But the problem is, because there is very little discernment as to the difference between what the individual Christian is doing in his vocation, that is, in his particular place in life, and what the church ought to be doing on Sunday morning with someone like Rick Warren, that confusion leads to the church can only be hurt when we pick up banners like deeds, not creeds. Well, let's just forget those things that divide us and start talking about those things that unite us. And Rick Warren has been completely open about this. He thinks that theology and doctrine divide, that the First Reformation hopelessly divided the church because it focused on belief. And what is needed is a second reformation that will focus on behavior that will unite and consolidate the church. And I got to wonder, if a church that's united not on belief but only on behavior, is that unity? It's the kind of unity the ecumenical movement has settled for in the last 30 years, where they just disagree to disagree about everything theological. But as long as you can drop money into the little mite box or whatever you give to the poor, well, then we're all together on that. It does tremendous damage to the church. So who best represents your view? Jerry Falwell? Bono? Can you think of someone in between? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. It's open lines. Your general reaction to the election, but also to our conversation with Lisa Miller. Everybody's saying that the shift in the evangelical and the religious voter has taken place. Do you think it has? Do you count yourself among those who have shifted? Remember, this is a good example of opening up Newsweek magazine and saying, does this describe me? Allowing yourself to be defined as a religious voter. So does the description fit? Does the definition fit? We're coming to you live this Thursday. It's the 9th of November, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. And I want to hear from you 10 more minutes in open lines. Chris calls from his car. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Todd. How are you today?
I'm doing good.
I'm not sure I identify with the religious right either. I think they have been too slavishly devoted to the president's every move for a long time. But I think what may be happening is not that their convictions are changing, but that their strategy is going to have to change to try to achieve those convictions.
What do you mean by that, Chris?
Well, you asked if they're losing power or losing influence. I mean, I think that their conviction about abortion, gay rights, stem cell research is probably as strong as it ever has been. Maybe the strategy that they've tried to use in the past isn't going to serve them well in the future. Does that make sense? So they're not going away. They just may have to regroup.
All right. Thank you. That's a possibility. I mean, that's what's being borne out by everyone who's observing this, and that is, look, the evangelical voter is as strong as he ever was, or she ever was, on gay marriage and abortion and these other issues. But they've added to their repertoire other issues that they're concerned about. Now, the assertion is being made that they're equally concerned about these other issues. I'm sorry. I do care about the environment. But if given a choice between abortion and the environment, I'm going to have to choose abortion every time. I do care about global poverty and the effect of AIDS in the world. I care deeply about it. But even then, it would still be a close second to something like abortion. I mean, you got to live before you can enjoy the prosperity of Western civilization or be beleaguered by poverty. You got to live first. Kia calls from Birmingham, Alabama. Kia, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well.
I kind of forgot my point while I was waiting, but, you know, if I remember it correctly, it's along the lines that I think one of the things that you see in the evangelical church is because so much of the way they worship is self-centered. I say this as a former evangelical, you know, part of one of those mega churches and things like that. Because it is, you know, self-centered worship, I think they have to have movements to do what they ought to be doing, like you said, in their vocation. I think if Christians were living out the gospel and understood the gospel and were living lives, you know, cruciform lives every day of their life, there wouldn't need to be this, you know, this political movement. The church wouldn't have to rally behind a president or anything like that. We would be doing our job. We would be affecting the lives of others the way we should, the way we've been called to do.
Kia, thank you very much. Kia has struck upon, I think, something. Now, I don't think I've ever thought of it in these terms, but I think she's absolutely right. Now, you might say, listening to Kia's comment there, oh, that's a stretch. Come on. These popular forms of worship among evangelicals, how could that have any effect on their outlook when they go out into the political realm? I think Kia's right. If you spend every Sunday morning worrying about helping yourself, me and Jesus, building the relationship between you and Jesus, turning inward on yourself and constantly taking your spiritual temperature. Am I worshipful enough? Am I sincere enough? Am I happy enough? I really should be happier on Sunday morning. Do I really love Jesus? All this self-referential worship is eventually going to make you feel a little guilty. You're going to say to yourself, wow, I spend that whole hour just worrying about... You may not say it in these terms, but your conscience will tell you, I just spent the last 2 hours on Sunday morning just wrapped up in myself. My own feelings, my own emotion, my own experience, my own mystical experience of God. Golly, maybe I should do something for somebody else. You know, it's like the person who goes out and splurges on a shopping spree, buy themselves a new wardrobe, and they come home and they feel a little guilty. Boy, I could have spent that on somebody else. Maybe I should. Next paycheck, I'll set some aside to spend it on somebody else. You spend that much time centering upon oneself and focusing on helping oneself, sure you're going to feel a little guilty when you get out there and you see that all that time you spent there on Sunday morning didn't do your neighbor much good. And to connect with the previous caller, if you lack a clear sense of what it means to serve your neighbor in love, in your vocation, that is where God has put you in life, and that it doesn't require extraordinary deeds of spiritual heroism, but in fact, simply doing what God has given you to do every day with your neighbor in mind rather than yourself, you will be hopelessly confused. You're going to be out there trying to change the world because you don't think you can affect any change right where you're at. You're going to think, well, I can't do anything right where I'm at. I'm going to have to make some big movement. It's going to have to be something big, spectacular, some big splash in the world. Like, for instance, the Global Peace Plan. It's Open Lines, Issues, Etc. this Thursday, November the 9th. You can call us 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us here in the studio as well. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Do you think that the era of the religious right as we have come to know it is coming to an end? Does Bono, rather than, say, Jerry Falwell, better represent your political and social concerns? Do you think that the religious right or evangelical voters are shifting? And if so, are you part of the shift? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, with the bad news of Amendment 2 passing here in Missouri, and I'll say in no uncertain terms, bad news with the passage of Amendment 2, and it's news that's only going to get worse as time goes by, there is some good news. It has to do not with embryonic stem cell research, but with stem cells that are derived from adult sources. Here's a story from Reuters on adult stem cells and how they are beginning to show some promise in the treatment of blindness, at least in mice.
These mice were blind, and now, thanks to a scientific breakthrough, they can see. They suffered genetically from macular degeneration, a condition where the light-sensitive cells die. It's a widespread condition in humans, especially among the elderly. Scientists at London's Moorfields Eye Hospital have managed to isolate the right kind of stem cells and transplant them into the mice's eyes.
We're transplanting them in such a way that they become fully incorporated into the host retina and make electrical connections. And we've shown for the first time with our experiments that when you shine a light in the eye, these transplanted cells can respond to the light and drive electrical signals which make the brain realize that the light is switched on, basically restoring vision.
It's very promising news for blind people who have been told there's no cure for their problem.
We're told there was no hope, there's never going to be a cure or a treatment, sort of don't go chasing any ideas. 20 years later, here we are, and there's, you know, a treatment round the corner. Obviously, it's a few years off yet, but, you know, it could make a huge difference to me and to other people suffering from retinal degeneration.
Researchers in Britain and America have recently found cells similar to stem cells on the edge of the human retina. Although human treatment is still years away, the future looks a lot brighter for the blind. Bennett Allen, Reuters.
Well, I think it's good news. I'm no scientist, but it sounds like if they're able to take stem cells from adult retinas, they're not talking about cloning human beings or cloning mice and getting their stem cells here. They're talking about getting adult stem cells, what are effectively adult stem cells, from sources where nobody needs to die, and transplanting them into the eyes of mice and then showing some promise for the curing at least of one form of degenerative blindness. Well, there you go again. one begins to wonder why in the world all the fuss is being made about embryonic stem cell research when you don't hear any stories like this about embryonic stem cells and what's being done with them. Most of the stories you hear from them are either pie-in-the-sky promises from researchers who are looking for big biotech dollars, or they are, sad to say, experiments that go terribly awry. The promise lies with, and it really shouldn't surprise us, the promise lies not with pitting one neighbor against the other, or pitting the neighbor against people who are well against people who are sick, or people who are underdeveloped with people who are fully developed. No, the promise lies with that kind of research that can be done without ethical compromise. All right, the questions I have for you. Does Bono represent your political and social concerns? He may represent your musical taste, but does he represent your political and social concerns? He's concerned about AIDS and global warming and poverty, and he's pro-life, too. Is that the kind of evangelical voter you are, or is it more along the lines of, oh, Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Here's another question for you. Now that the Democrats have control of the Senate, and they do, now that they have control of the Senate, what are your hopes for the next Supreme Court nominee? The president might have an opportunity. There's at least two rather elderly Supreme Court justices right now. One of them is, if I'm not mistaken, an octogenarian. That means he's over 80. You can't live forever. So the president might have, in the next 2 years, an opportunity to appoint at least one more Supreme Court nominee. It may be one of those swing votes that could be replaced with an anti-Roe vote. But the Senate is now controlled by the Democratic Party. Do you think there's even a snowball's chance that they will let such a nominee through? Issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. When we come back from this break, we'll be talking with Sally Henriksen. She's Mercy Medical Coordinator for LCMS World Relief, and she's going to talk about some medical mercy being done in Kenya. Before we go to that break, let's talk with Greg, who calls from his car. Greg, welcome.
Hi, I appreciate your topics today. Hey, the thing that occurs to me is, I guess I would probably be considered religious right, I guess labeled that way, but I don't think I would consider myself evangelical as you describe it. I'm not Lutheran, but I think there's a distinction, and so I think it's difficult to ask some of the questions you're making. I think what I hear you saying is a lot of charismatics sort of share some of these, selfishness that's involved in going to worship. And well, I think that there's a difference there.
All right, Greg, thank you. I don't know if it could include charismatics, but I don't think it is only charismatics. When I talk about these self-centered worship practices, I'm not talking about charismatics or Pentecostals or the fringe. I'm talking about what is now the mainstream of American evangelicalism, where you get into church and on Sunday morning you've got 45 minutes of music that's basically you talking about how you feel. Now, you mention Jesus in there occasionally, but you're talking more about how you feel about Jesus than what Jesus has done for you. And look, with that kind of self-centered worship, you're going to feel a little guilty when you're done with 2 hours after focusing on yourself again and again and again. When we come back, we're going to talk about what's being done in Kenya with medical mercy. Sally Henriksen will be our guest.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Historical theology is not just a bunch of names and dates and fact. It's the study of Christ being faithful to his promises.
Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of historical theology.
Historical theology is the study of theology over the course of time, just like the title says, theology over the course of time. But that can lead some to think that this is a dry, kind of an abstract endeavor, when in fact what we're talking about with historical theology is the faithful confession ongoing through the church by people that Christ has called, seeing him fulfill the promise that he will never leave the church orphaned or forsaken.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. Arguments were heard yesterday both inside and outside the U.S. Supreme Court as justices took on the momentous partial birth abortion ban. The National Organization for Women showed up on the steps of the High Court, just yards away from the Christian Defense Coalition. Kim Troby reports each side's protest said a lot about their stance on the issue.
Politics is often more about semantics than anything else, and for years the pro-abortion movement has been successful using words to advance their cause. Tom Condit is with the Life Legal Defense Foundation.
The abortion industry and their supporters with organizations like NOW, it's always been about defining the debate and using terms that have more to do with propaganda than reality.
Outside the court yesterday, NOW supporters held a rally to protest what they term so-called partial birth abortion. Condit says it's important they continue to cloud the debate with terminology.
The abortion industry has no choice but to just keep trying to win the propaganda war, because medically it's pretty clear that this is just killing a little baby.
Also on the Supreme Court steps was the Christian Defense Coalition, but for a very different reason. They met to conduct a 24-hour prayer vigil. Bruce Hauskonecht, legal analyst for Focus on the Family Action and former pastor.
In order to change the hearts and minds of people, they should be on their knees asking God to change those hearts first.
In 2000, the High Court heard a similar case, Stenberg v. Carhart, and judges struck down the ban in Nebraska. But Hauskonecht predicts a pro-life ending this time around. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
Congress compiled research to back its claim that the procedure is never medically necessary, and the new makeup of the High Court gives pro-lifers hope that they can win. For Family News in Focus, I'm Bob Dittmer.
Hi, I'm Phyllis Wallace. You want to lose weight to look fabulous, don't you? That means, very simply, taking control of your eating to take off a few pounds. It's possible. You just need to do a few little things. Dr. Joel Robertson will explain how to learn to eat in a way that lets you look and feel your absolute best. Next time, Woman to Woman.
Saturday mornings at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
You can read an excerpt of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, titled The Great Jesus Debates, on our website, issuesetc.org. It's a book about the battle in the early church over the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Great Jesus Debates is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. The Great Jesus Debates costs $14.99 plus shipping and handling. That title again, The Great Jesus Debates.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Here in the halfway point through the program, Sally Henriksen joins us. We're going to be talking about medical mercy being done in the African country of Kenya. We spend a lot of time talking about Kenya recently on the program. The situation there is, well, I guess you could say it's a diverse situation, but one of the things we need to talk about is the medical situation. We were mentioning before the break people's concerns for the global AIDS crisis. Well, if you want to see the global AIDS crisis up close and in person, you go to a country like Kenya. Sally Henriksen is a regular guest. She's Mercy Medical Coordinator for LCMS World Relief. Sally, welcome back. Thanks for coming over.
Thanks, Todd, for having me.
You just got back from several weeks in Kenya. Tell us about your trip. Just give us your impressions, the whole sweep of it.
It was wonderful. It was a very life-changing experience. Words can hardly describe it. LCMS World Relief and Human Care had been approached by different groups and medical people saying, why aren't we doing something medically overseas as Lutherans, as a group? So we decided we would start a pilot project, and this was our first trip of getting together some LCMS medical professionals to go do and volunteer their services overseas at their own expense. So I coordinated with the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Kenya to set up several days of medical camps. We went to the Kibera slums of Nairobi, which is one of the largest slums in the world. They're not sure how many people are there, but it's over a million living in the slums outside Nairobi, a very, very poor, congested, dirty, trashy, filthy place. And in these slums, there is a Lutheran church called Spring of Life Lutheran Church for the ELCK. It actually has a spring on the church property that bubbles into the ground where people will come to get fresh water. So it's a really, really neat site they have there. They want to build a clinic. We're working to help them do that. So we started by offering a free medical camp. So we spent a week with the team. We had two LCMS doctors and three nurses and two volunteers.
And especially there in the slum, what kind of things were you looking at? What kind of situations were presenting themselves to you that were of the most immediate need among the people who lived there?
Well, I think most of the illnesses we saw were related to AIDS, HIV/AIDS, malaria, and poor sanitation and living conditions. No access to clean water and clean sanitation. Therefore, you have a lot of, you know, intestinal illnesses and things that are spread, communicable illnesses. A lot of general aches and pains, and which was something I didn't really consider until I got there. And then I realized all these women are walking with 20-pound feed sacks on their heads or 5-gallon buckets of water. Kids, everybody, always hauling, scrounging, working hard, looking for means to get by. So, yeah, lots of body aches and pains. And then, again, the general illnesses from malaria, which is mosquito-borne, and then the HIV and AIDS.
So, okay, with the general sanitation, which leads to a lot of the other problems, and with malaria, you can teach some basic hygiene and sanitation things to help people mitigate the situation and perhaps suppress it. But AIDS is a whole different story. I mean, it's not only passed down from parents to children, the case where the parents have it, but it's also, I guess, tied up with the culture over there. And so talk a bit about the monumental problem that is the AIDS crisis in Kenya.
The AIDS crisis there's been some of a dent made in it. I think I heard quoted that it had been like 600 deaths a day, and now it's down to about 500. So there's been some progress made through the African continent because of efforts with, you know, people like Bono and the federal government and the work like our church and the ELCK has done a lot to work with their people of understanding how you contract AIDS and the importance of being tested and counseling. But part of the problem is culturally how the people live. The other thing is it's a poor country. It's a relatively new country because they were occupied by the British up until, I think, 1964. So jobs are hard to come by. So it wasn't uncommon, like the man that was the keeper at the guest house for us, he lived in Nairobi and lives full time at the guest house. His family lives in another town many, many miles across western Kenya. He'll go months without seeing his wife and children. Well, that sets people up for, let's say, you know, bad behavior or
Well, the problem there is prostitution, isn't it?
Yeah. So there's prostitution or, you know, you miss your wife and you end up, you know, with somebody else for a night. So that's spreads things as well and causes more problems. The biggest thing we saw with the AIDS there at the time is the fact that men contract AIDS, they give it to their wives, or their wives are then HIV positive. The man dies. Now we have widows and children. Now, so we have a lot of women and orphans. So some of the other time that I was there, I also spent visiting some of the projects that we're working with in conjunction with the ELCK, which are there was a seminar, an all-day seminar for the women in Nairobi, Kenya, who are either HIV positive or have full-blown AIDS that are widows, and how to provide for themselves. So kind of like a micro-enterprise seminar and how to start your own business, how to provide for yourself and your children. There's some other outlying areas we went to. I went to Dago. We started a center there where they have a preschool for the children, one teacher with 52 children already.
Wow.
And the women then are being taught how to raise goats for the nutritious milk for themselves and then also to sell, and then also, again, learning microenterprise skills and how to take care of themselves because they're sick and they have children that are dependent on them now because they've lost their husbands through AIDS.
You said it was life-changing, and I think we've talked to probably six individuals in the course of talking about Kenya and the other aspects of the AIDS crisis and the need over there, who have said exactly the same thing when they came back. Even if they went there for the third or fourth time, they come back and they still talk about it as life-changing. So what is it about going and seeing not only the country in general, but these people in particular that is life-changing?
I think, one, Africa is a very beautiful place, beautiful in a different kind of way. I saw, you know, kind of desert, scrubby, kind of remind you of Arizona. Then I saw lush, green, mountainous, you know, the sugar plant and tea plantations. But the people themselves are so beautiful. And the church members I met there, they truly, truly understand how to live daily in the mercy of God. They really do. Because these people, for the most part, have nothing. And as little as they have, they'll turn around and share with you. I had the clinic, we saw over 825 people in 4 days with three doctors and three nurses. And that was including us manning the pharmacy. The pharmacy was set up in the church sanctuary. They had gated doors that they could close the iron gates, but not the doors. And then the medications were distributed that way to the people who came to the clinic. And when I was working our third day at the clinic, part of the group went to see another project, so we were short-staffed, and the word had gotten out, so it was very crowded. We were very tired, and I was working downstairs being Dr. Sally and seeing patients. It also changes your idea of what medical practice is when you go there. It's a little different. And one of the church members who helped organize it asked me, said, you're needed upstairs. And I thought, oh, what now? So I went up to the pharmacy. Well, there was a woman standing there with a Walmart or Schnucks bag crumpled up in her hands. And I recognized her. And it turned out I had seen her previously in the clinic. And she came to me and she said, I have something for you. And I opened up this bag and she had made the most beautiful woven, like straw mats. They look like pot holders. And she said, these are for you. She said, I want to thank you. She said, you've given my people hope. And I mean, it just made me stop and realize what little we did, how much that touched her, and it was like the widow's mite. For her to give me something like that was like if I would have given her a car or something. That it was truly, they gave, you know, gifts from their heart, and they're just really beautiful people and really understand the love of Christ. It was interesting, too, while we were working, that the church elders and evangelists were all there and talking. You could see them sharing the gospel and giving hope and the gospel to these people.
What was the church like? You said you were working out of a church. And, of course, what I picture in my mind, probably out of ignorance, is typical kind of church building you drive by in suburban America. And I picture that kind of a neighborhood, maybe with, you know, older vehicles or something like that. But what are we talking about? What was the church like as a facility, but then also as the people gathered together?
The church, the group came in on a Saturday evening, and then the next morning we worshiped two services, one in the cathedral in Nairobi and then also at the Kibera Slum Church. The Slum Church would be kind of like your average, maybe rural or suburban church here. It's just a brick building. There were benches that were not like your formal pews, but more like a park bench kind of set up in a, you know, chancel area. They followed the liturgy. We had translators. The service was in Swahili. One of our pastors that went along preached, and it was translated. So they preached for the group. The down lower part of the church had just stuff in it, you know, supplies and odd chairs and things. And after service, we went down and kind of sized it up. And that's where they put our clinic, was in the church basement. They built frameworks and stapled fabric to it to make like six little cubicles. And then because it's temperate there, the tables were set outside in the churchyard for registration of patients. There was a tent set up where they gave immunizations outside. The government nurses came and gave immunizations to the young children, and we also had deworming medication. It was a, it'd be like a more like a rural church with a big grassy yard, but yet you could see the garbage and the busyness of the road right up, you know, at the top of the church. But they have this extra property that they purchased that they want to build a medical facility on. They also have a preschool there, so kind of off a ways there was a separate building that housed the preschool that they the church provides during the week.
We're talking with Sally Hendrickson. She's a medical mercy coordinator for LCMS World Relief, and we're talking about medical mercy being done in the African country of Kenya. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us at issuesetc@kfuo.org. You said before that it changed your view of what medical practice is. You're an RN, am I correct?
Yes.
Okay, so you know what it's like to practice medicine at that level here in the United States. What was different about that?
Well, the difference was, and for some of the medical professional as well, there's, you know, we had no tongue blades, we had no otoscope, we had no scales, you know. So it was a, you have to make some mental switches here to prescribe medications when you don't know how much somebody weighs. Or, you know, just be able to look in a throat a little better with a, you know, without the help of a tongue blade, things like that. So the supplies, we were running on a lean set of things there. And then the medications, again, we purchase the medications. We purchase those ahead of time and get a good price on them by buying them overseas there and prescribe them. But then when you don't have certain medications, you substitute. And when those run out, you substitute again. And when you run out, you know, then you have to say, I'm sorry, we don't have anything.
What kind of medications were you giving out to people? I mean, someone's got to wonder, how do you plan for that? You're going to see a whole city or a whole village of people with who haven't had any kind of medical care to speak of. How do you plan for that? What are you prescribing to people?
Well, the good thing was one of our team members was Dr. Anita Scribner. She's an LCMS member from Longview, Texas, and she's an HIV infectious disease specialist. So she helped me place the order. So I had a lot of good help. But we gave out lots of ibuprofen, lots of Tylenol, lots of cough medicine, you know, your antibiotics, things that kids for, you know, just your regular run-of-the-mill stuff you get from your own pediatrician for your own children. For the adults, a lot of gastroesophageal reflux kind of medications, as well as antimalarials, you know, a lot of antimalarial drugs, antibiotics. And then for the HIV, we really can't do antiretrovirals, but we could test, and then we could give them, if they came to the clinic and had the stamp on the card, that got them a referral to the government.
And could the government give them the cocktail of antiretrovirals that they would need there?
Well, that was the frustration for Anita, is that they can get medications, but it wouldn't necessarily be, it's not comparable treatment to what we have available here. And that's the hard thing, is the disparity between what's available stateside and what's available there, because of the difference in their medical system and then also just access. So, you know, one of our goals with starting this is to get more LCMS medical people interested in helping support us in the project, either by financial donations or to, if they want to attend, to provide their own time and pay their way to go and help us provide treatment as well. I'm also, another side part of this is I ship medical equipment, used medical equipment. So we're working right now. I have a container for Sudan and one for Kenya that we're looking to organize and ship this medical equipment over there to help. We took a Bovie with us for one of the doctors in Kenya, which we take for granted here, that all the hospitals and the operating rooms, which is a cautery.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very excited that they were going to have that now once we took that with us.
One other question on the AIDS medication. Is it a matter of money not being able to get comparable treatment for AIDS patients there as opposed to here? Or is it a matter of those medications are simply not available over there? Which is it?
I'm not really sure. I think it's a combination of things. I think it's a combination of, we have so much available to us here. I think there's the cost involved. I think there's also the expertise and the medical training and the difference in technology and knowledge that we have medically here versus, you know, this is still third world country, so that their level of training for physicians, et cetera, what they call, you know, their nurses would be compared to probably like our LPNs, and then they have clinical officers. So it's a whole different system setup of how they distribute medical care.
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kathy's waiting in St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering the amount or number of people that would have been seen, you know, in a clinic like that with disability or special needs.
Thank you very much, Kathy. What about special needs? Did you see any kids?
We did. We did have some, and it was amazing because, to me, I thought these people's lives are so hard as it is, and then to have a child with special needs besides. I saw at one point a woman who had a child that obviously had cerebral palsy and some type of brain damage that was brought in, but that was not the the main complaint. Then the other site that we went, not only to Cabrera, we went to another rural place called Atemo. There was a woman there who literally crawled on her hands and knees because of her deformity and disability. And we saw her later that afternoon when she left the clinic crawling up the hillside home. So, yeah, there was some there. It's not as much visible because of the disparity of how difficult it is to get around. But you do see some people that if you can't walk in Kenya, you're in trouble. You see people walking everywhere all the time. There were probably a half dozen people I saw the time I was there that had like a bicycle kind of rig-up thing that they could get around that pedaled with their hands.
When you came back, when did you get back?
October 20th.
Okay, when you came back, what was the biggest adjustment for you coming back to the United States to, you know, middle America, middle class America? What was the biggest adjustment for you?
I think the food, eating three meals a day. I didn't do that much while I was there. They have something called ugali, which is a corn flour paste that's eaten kind of like a dough in your hand with like a stew or a meat. And so I had a lot of that while I was there. I traveled and stayed a lot with local families and ate more of local type food. So just you would get up in the morning, you might have coffee and toast or something, and then you'd go all day and, you know, then eat in the evening. So, yeah, I lost 10 pounds. It was great.
Sounds like the Wilkin diet. That's what I do. I get up and eat nothing until it's dinner time, but then I eat like a pig.
Yeah.
So any other adjustments to returning here and then kind of seeing again the contrast from going to the U.S. to Kenya and then going from Kenya after a couple of weeks back to the U.S.?
Yeah, I think the hard part about coming back was that I knew I would miss the people. You know, it's a simpler life in a lot of ways, you know, because it's not all things and machines, and it's a little more agrarian. Lots of people everywhere all the time, people always walking. You always see people on the side of the road and animals, and you know, just that was the thing that really stuck out in my mind, is just constantly seeing people upon people upon people. There are so many people there. And then coming back to all the stuff, you know, where here it's all stuff. It's about stuff. We have TVs and cars and, you know, all this industrialized kind of life. So that kind of not being, you know, just out where there's kind of like trees and a few big brick buildings and people.
Although I do remember when Mark Sell was in with us a couple of weeks ago, and he had made his first trip, or I think second trip, probably to Kenya, if I'm not mistaken. He said, and went to many of the same places. He was with the Maasai tribe and doing some work with them on some special projects. And he said, you're sitting there around an open fire, men in traditional Maasai garb, the red robes. Mm-hmm. Everybody's barefoot. You're sitting on the ground. And all of a sudden, the chief gets a call on his cell phone. I'm sorry, I have to take this kind of a thing. It's a contrast in cultures, there isn't it?
Yeah, there is. There is. In fact, I have a picture like that from when we took the group out to see the Maasai Mara to see the animals. And I have a photo of one of the Maasai guys squatting down in his traditional garb with his cell phone. And I thought, boy, if this isn't a telephone commercial in the making. But, yeah, everybody has cell phones there. Now, they may not have minutes for them, but they have cell phones because, you know, our driver, the housekeeper, everybody had a cell phone, but theirs are set up different that, you know, you buy the minutes as you go. So a lot of times you might try calling somebody and there's no minutes left. But
sounds like my house. That's how we do our cell phones around the Wilkin house. Finally, talk about the pastors, if you would. These are the men, the indigenous pastors there, who are on the ground. They're living exactly the same way the people do. And they're getting around without a car, sometimes without a bike.
It's
all those kind of things. Talk about those men there.
The pastors there and the evangelists are absolutely wonderful people. And the pastors are the pastors. The evangelists are kind of like an assistant pastor, and they kind of run things and do catechesis while the pastor's away. A lot of the pastors, it's not uncommon for them to have 5, 6, 9 congregations. So they can't be at church every Sunday.
Spread out over what?
Miles. And it's all on foot. And they will, one of the vicars that I visited with, he's a Fort Wayne vicar doing vicarage there, was saying he was with one of the pastors that covers 9 congregations. So he doesn't get to his congregation, but every couple of months, you know, he can't be there every Sunday. So the evangelists will run things. Well, if there's no pastor, there's no sacrament. The other thing is, even if there is a pastor, I was surprised that we, because it's, you know, they follow their liturgy, they're sacramental, that we had no sacrament. We'll come to find out it's because they can't afford the communion wine. It's too expensive. So there was no sacrament, which was very sad. So I met and sat in on it with a group that they're working with the Tanzanians to learn how to make wine, and they're investigating because it's such a highly taxed. The government now taxes the wine so that the church can't afford to buy wine to have communion service.
And that's a real need.
Yeah. I can't get your forgiveness of sins. It's a real problem.
Sally Hedrickson is Medical Mercy Coordinator for LCMS World Relief. This is just a taste of what they're doing worldwide, but we focused here in this last half hour on Kenya. To find out more about it or to earmark a donation for their work in Kenya, the need is obviously great. You can give them a call toll-free, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438, or you can find their logo at our homepage. That's the LCMS World Relief logo at issuesetc.org. Thank you very much for being our guest and for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
When we come back, audio open lines. We're going to begin with the National Public Radio story on the arguments that were heard by the Supreme Court yesterday, the arguments that were made in front of the justices, some of the questions that they asked of the lawyers who were making their arguments about the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. Of course, a decision from the Supreme Court is expected within a couple months, but we'll hear as much as we can hear of what went on yesterday in the Supreme Court when we come back from this break, and then from people on both sides of the issue of banning partial birth abortion. It's audio open lines when we come back. Get ready to call 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address. This break is a great time to call or email us, issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. They're saying that if the Supreme Court is able to uphold the ban on partial birth abortion, it may be the first crack in the wall to regulating abortion as it most regularly happens. We'll be right back.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.